Well, good evening, everybody. Thanks very much for coming out. I know you don't have too many alternatives. TV on Wednesday night's pretty slow, so it's good to see you all. I do have to say this. If you're here expecting the cold McDonald's hamburgers, you're in the wrong place. They serve those at the White House. So sorry. We're not up to those standards here at the Alturas Institute. I really enjoyed our program last week. You asked such terrific questions on that very, very important question of whether America is a democracy or a republic. Grenada, Granada, either, either, tomato, tomato. We're going to create a song here. It's going to be the Alturas song. And you'll all get your music sheets here very, very soon. So a great deal is going on in our country these days. Well, in some areas, not much is going on. 800,000 federal employees are not working, or else if they're working, they're not being paid. But I think if you do work and you're not paid, we call that a hobby. So I don't know what they're going to characterize this as. A number of you ask, by the way, just as you came in today, about whether or not the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, could uninvite President Donald Trump and reschedule the State of the Union address. And I know that's a burning issue on all of your minds. So let's address that before we get in to tonight's material. Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution simply provides that the president from time to time shall provide information to Congress on the State of the Union. There is no declaration, no stated obligation with respect to how that information is to be provided or when it is to be provided, whether in writing or speaking. And in fact, our first two presidents did in fact go to Congress to provide a State of the Union address, George Washington and John Adams, and they believed that it was important for them to speak in person with members of Congress. But when Thomas Jefferson became president, he disowned that practice, thinking that it smacked too much of the monarchy in England when the king would come down to Parliament and speak down to Parliament. And so he abandoned the idea of delivering a spoken address, and he simply began to deliver a message to Congress in writing. That practice, that tradition held until Woodrow Wilson in 1913 reinvoked the idea of delivering a speech to Congress, and since then, every president has followed suit. We'll see whether or not President Trump in fact does make an appearance before Congress in a joint session, or whether he'll be relegated to simply submitting the State of the Union on paper. What's behind all this? It's fascinating politics, isn't it? President Trump clearly wants the great platform, the nationally televised joint address, so that he can bash Democrats for the ongoing denial to 800,000 workers, did I say that before? The denial to 800,000 workers of the opportunity to work. And of course, Nancy Pelosi, as the Speaker, does not want to provide that forum to President Trump. And so I think unless he's willing to schedule the date, which is what she's asked for, then he will be forced to submit the message in writing. So it may go on. We may see that with the shutdown going on for days, dare I say weeks, we may not have a State of the Union well into February or beyond. Yeah, please. Yes. He could. And indeed, that might be a very popular alternative for him to do another nationally televised address from the Oval Office, in which he could explain that why he's not in Congress delivering this annual nationally televised joint address before Congress. He would have to weigh the politics of that. And isn't it fascinating to see how politicians, office holders, perform the calculus on these opportunities in the political world? Of course, while that would work for him and he could read from a teleprompter, it might not satisfy him because he loves the rounds of applause. So you know that when a president delivers a State of the Union, you expect to get 25 to 40 standing ovations. Who doesn't like a standing ovation? We like them here too, by the way, if it ever occurs to you. So he would be deprived of that. You might wonder also who actually issues the invitation. It is the Speaker of the House. It is true that both chambers have to sign off on the date for the State of the Union, but here it would be unavailing for Republicans in the Senate to stipulate a date, and Nancy Pelosi turns down that offer of a date. So this is going to go on for a while, and sadly, it's going to go on because we see the two sides at an impasse. So more on that later. Anyway, that's the answer to a couple questions. Yes, please.
Sorry, really quick. What if he decided not to give one or just try not to?
Well, very good question. Is he obligated to deliver the State of the Union in this form? No. He could deliver information about the State of the Union at any different point in time. And in fact, in the State of the Union clause, which is in Article 2, Section 3, is followed immediately by what we call the Recommendations Clause. And there, the framers of the Constitution simply expected that from time to time, at any time, the president might make recommendations to Congress regarding legislation, legislative programs, policies, ideas for laws, and those would be submitted into writing. So you ask a really excellent question, and the president might be satisfied to simply submit a report at any different time. So this is an unusual year. We could say this is an unconventional presidency, and this may be an unconventional State of the Union address. So stay tuned. Any other questions? Yes, please.
Facetious statement. There's 500 in Washington that are getting paid and not working.
That's right. That's an excellent point. And I know that was not a campaign speech because you're not a candidate, unless you're planning to enter the crowded field for the presidency in 2020. More, everybody's welcome. That's right. Oh, yes, sir. Please, yes.
I want to know where's the law that says he can make people work for nothing?
Good question. Where's the law that indicates that some workers can be required? It's in federal law that people who work in certain key positions involving national security, safety, and so forth can be required to show up at the office. And it is clear that at some point when the shutdown ends that Congress will, in fact, provide all of the workers with their usual salary. It just comes a little bit later than usual. But you all wouldn't mind, would you, to go to work and get your paycheck another month or two later than you expect? The very serious part of this, of course, is the impact not only on the lives of the workers, but the lives of the communities where they live and the economy nationally. And so this is a very serious crisis in our country's history. We're moving closer and closer toward a month, and it raises that question about the possibility of governance. After all, when you ask the question, what do we expect our federal government to do, we would like people in the federal government to govern, and as you suggest, to work. And here in this case, because of political divisions, we find ourselves at an impasse, and it's not clear when it will be resolved. Both sides are digging in. Yes, please.
I wanted to follow up on Betty's question. It seems that there were certain criteria like national security, and I think a couple others, where the workers could be asked to come back and work without pay. But would that include agriculture because they need loans, or the IRS because they want to get the tax returns up?
Right. Very good question. So we have broad criteria for a presidential declaration of which federal workers are required to return and to perform their duties. You'll be happy to know the IRS is, in fact, returning to work. I don't know if that's good news for Idahoans. Idahoans might prefer if the IRS agents stay out. But you raise a very good point about agriculture and about any number of governmental services and programs. And think about this, if any of you have been flying any place in the country over the last couple of weeks, I wonder if you've experienced any slowness going through those security lines. We never move slowly through those security lines, but there's always a first opportunity for that. In Miami, a terminal was closed down. So we feel the impact across the nation, and it's likely to get worse. At what point, then, will the American people rally to place sufficient pressure on both sides to demand a resolution of the issue? And then that raises the question from a political perspective of which side will cave, which side will weaken. And so I don't expect that the president is going to cave, and I certainly don't expect this very, very tough Speaker of the House to cave at any point in time either.
What about the court cases that have been filed? Are they likely to go anywhere?
Good, very good question. In fact, on NPR, as I was driving over here, and the local representative of NPR is KISU, I'm very happy to say, presenting this news program, I heard a report indicating that immigration courts are now closed, and they have a backlog of some 800,000 cases in this country. Can you believe that? And, of course, that list will grow. So some courts will be closed. I had hoped to see a lot of federal judges here tonight because they're not working.
But what about the cases that have been filed to require payment of the wages to the workers who are being required to work? Have those been filed and will they actually?
That's a really good question. So the federal judges will sit on those cases. Federal courts around the country are open. And that, when you raise a really good question, because if federal courts closed across the country, that would represent a real assault on American democracy, because the key to the maintenance of our democracy is, in fact, protecting our institutions, which is what I'm going to get to tonight after we finish the Q&A. We flipped this tonight. In case you haven't noticed, we're doing Q&A first. But it's one thing for the immigration courts to be closed. It's another for all the other federal courts to close. If you think back to one of the gravest crises in American history during the Civil War, when at a critical point, President Lincoln wanted to close some of the federal courts on the grounds that we were convulsed by the national emergency, the Supreme Court rendered a ruling saying that the president did not have the authority to close the federal courts unless the usual law enforcement officers were so overwhelmed by the convulsions of the Civil War that the courts could not perform their duties. Those aren't the circumstances which we meet now. But you ask a number of good questions, and don't you just wonder how federal employees feel about being asked, or in some cases required, to perform their duties? So think about the members of the Coast Guard out there patrolling the high seas, looking for illegal means of entry of illegal drugs. And would there be the possibility, because they're not paid very much, will there be the possibility that back home they might have children, family members, and they are living paycheck to paycheck, which is true for a lot of federal employees, as it is so true of Americans from coast to coast. Are they wondering, why am I out here working? I'm now going to miss my second paycheck, which really means the loss of 1 month's income. And as you know, most Americans don't have savings to withstand the absence of a month's pay. Coast Guard members, others in federal employment are facing those positions. How dedicated will they be? Will their hearts be in it? Because in some places, those who have been furloughed have assumed temporary work to earn some money in their community. So this is a desperate matter, and you can see the political waters growing intensely hot and reaching a boiling point, and fingers are being pointed, who's to blame? If you look at the national polls, at least right now, 53% of the Americans blame President Trump, 47 or so blame the Democrats. We'll see how those polling figures stand up over the coming days. These are great questions. Thank you. Yes, please. Yes, excellent question, and you're right. So that is, of course, the case that on any legislation passed by both chambers, presented to the president under the presentment clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 5, that in fact the president then has a choice to sign the bill into law or to return it. And if it's returned, then as you indicate, if the Congress can in fact override the president's veto, but we have to have two-thirds of both chambers. You could imagine getting two-thirds of the House. You're not likely to get two-thirds of the Senate right now, because remember, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has already said he will not present to the president any bill that the president will not sign. And that's all about saving the president from being embarrassed by party members voting against him. Right. So good question. So the mechanics for this shutdown reflect the fact, A, that both chambers did approve appropriations about 3 weeks ago, Republicans and Democrats, and the president had indicated he was prepared to support it, therefore we would avoid a shutdown. But then as we got within hours of the need for him to sign, he said, no, this $5.2 billion will be dedicated to the building of a wall, or I won't sign. And of course, that's when both sides dug in. So we're still waiting. It seems very likely that if Mitch McConnell did present the same measure to the Senate, that it would indeed pass. We would have probably the same numbers, or maybe even greater numbers in the Senate now, after nearly a month-long shutdown. But Mitch McConnell won't, in fact, do that because, he wants to spare the president the embarrassment. At some point, given the growing pressure on Republican senators, there will be that moment, that telling moment, when they decide to say they will break from the president. In this game of chicken, so to speak, both sides are trying to avoid the necessity of pulling off to the side of the road. Yes, in the back, please.
What consequences are the people that are being required to work, if everybody just said they're not going to work?
Oh, right. Very good question. What would be the consequences? Did you want to answer that? Please.
PATCO. August 3rd, 1981.
Yes, and explain that for us. Ronald Reagan.
Most of the air traffic controllers in America went on strike. And on August 3rd, Ronald Reagan said, either go back to work or lose your job. And there were tens of thousands of people that lost their jobs.
Yeah, right.
So the president gets to decide if...
Yes, so they could... Exactly. Thanks very much. So they can be fired. Plus, we have a federal law that prohibits some federal workers from going on strike. Those who are crucial to national security. So the president in this case, thank you, in referring to President Reagan and the air traffic controller strike in 81, in this case, after a month-long shutdown, President Trump does not want to be the person who would say to those federal workers, you're fired. That would be a bad, bad political move. So they might have, as you suggest, it might be a tactic. A strong-arm tactic. The employee says, not coming back to work until we get paid. Would President Trump then take that bold step and say, you're fired? We've heard him say that on his television show a few times. I doubt it. I don't think he would. So this is where we have an opportunity for employees to assert their rights. unless they are workers in a national security area in which they're prohibited from striking. That would take some organization, wouldn't it? Yeah, good question. Thank you. Others, any other questions? I'm afraid we're out of time for tonight. Thank you all for coming. All right, well, there'll be more questions. And I love the questions you ask and the opportunity it permits us to roam widely and dig deeply. So having concluded last week that the framers of our Constitution created a democratic republic, and to remind you, they would not have been offended if you referred to American government as a democracy or a republic, because they treated those terms as synonyms. People as different as Thomas Paine and Alexander Hamilton both referred to the American governmental system as a democratic republic. It also means that they shunned the idea of creating a direct democracy, or what might have been referred to as a pure democracy. Instead, our founders opted to create a constitutional democracy. So that's how we refer to our system, as a constitutional democracy, in its shape, in its manner, in its form. Why did the framers create a constitutional democracy, and how can we say that with authority? Because you recall that the American people were characterized as the sovereign entity in America. We did not have a sovereign king or a queen. We didn't have a sovereign parliament. Americans decided for themselves that we, the people, will be sovereign. Having made the decision then to exercise our popular sovereignty through our willingness to ratify the proposed Constitution in 1787 and 1788, we essentially stated to the country, we, the people, have approved this proposed form of government, and we denominate it a constitutional democracy, because our Constitution defines our democracy. The Constitution, as you know, limits governmental power. It grants broad powers. It imposes responsibilities and duties. It shapes the way governmental power is exercised. It divides it, for example, as you know, into three basic branches: the legislative, the executive, and the judiciary. And it further then allocates powers, as James Iredell of the original Supreme Court, of the first Supreme Court, said it very nicely. We have approved the Constitution that allocates powers in a particular way and divides responsibilities in a different way. So while all might be up for grabs on day one before the Constitution is created, and allowing that our democracy could take any shape whatsoever, our framers shaped it, molded it, pushed it in particular directions by placing it under a constitution. So sometimes we would face the prospect in this country that certain governmental practices might be constitutional but might also be undemocratic, and that would be a tension that we would face. Let me say that again. We could face a number of possibilities in our country where governmental actions, policies, and laws could be perfectly constitutional but undemocratic. Let me give you a couple of examples. So before women earned the right to vote, we would say in this country, it's perfectly undemocratic to deny women the right to vote, but until the Constitution was amended to grant that, there was no constitutional right. Or we could say at the beginning, it would certainly seem undemocratic for our founders to enslave people based on the color of their skin, but there was no constitutional prohibition on that. Others might say, before we amended the Constitution to give people the right to vote when they turned 18 years of age, but nevertheless we sent them to wars abroad, we might say how undemocratic it is to send young men to their graves when they're not given a constitutional right to vote. So we can see that tension appearing. And oh, by the way, and we'll come back to this issue, there is that matter of the Electoral College, which many people would say while it's nevertheless entrenched in the Constitution, seems on its face to be undemocratic. Why? Because it deprives the American people of making the fundamental choice about who's going to sit in the White House to represent them in the presidency. And in this last election, again, we saw that Hillary Clinton, in this case, won 3 million more popular votes than Donald Trump did, thus reflecting the popular will, the will of the sovereign people, but the will of the sovereign people was denied by virtue of the practice of the Electoral College. So we might say, to wrap this up, here we have a constitutional creature called the Electoral College, but the election of somebody who receives only a minority of the popular vote, who is in effect the silver medalist in this race, prohibiting the gold medalist from taking the office, seems to be undemocratic. So there you have a few examples to illustrate the fact that we can have tension between what we would call democratic principles and the way our Constitution governs. Ideally, what we would do, if we believe in democracy, is we would have them run together. They would be on all fours, so to speak. But that takes time, and it's often difficult politically. At any rate, the founders then created a constitutional democracy. They recognize the fragility of their great experiment. There certainly was nothing in history to suggest that their experiment in this democratic republic would prevail, that it would be successful in the near term or even the long term. And so they were very nervous about it. The question arose, how do we maintain our constitutional democracy? And so now we turn to the meat of what I want to present tonight, and that is by an appeal to maintain the institutions that govern this nation, the institutions that also form the backbone of the American democracy, the institutions of government, certainly the three branches, the legislative, the courts, and the executive, but also all the many governmental agencies and offices created by Congress. Those are institutions. And of course, we have to remember that there are other institutions such as the press, and that's very important to protect if we're to maintain our constitutional democracy. So when we look at the basics of how the founders proposed to protect and to strengthen the Union, they emphasized first and foremost the need to preserve the three institutions of government. This in and of itself was quite an undertaking, because their own experience under King George III in England represented the personalization of power. Think about that. The personalization of power. All governmental power was essentially vested in the king until the English Civil Wars in the mid-17th century, and then some independent agencies were created. Parliament had its own powers, but in no way resembling the separation of powers that our founders created. So the framers of our Constitution were trying to move from a system which personalized power, concentrated power in a kingship, to the idea of depersonalizing political power, spreading it about through the three institutions and setting forth in writing which powers and responsibilities would be vested in each of the three branches of government. Of course, Congress would come first because, as James Madison said in the Federalist Papers, in a republic, the legislature is the primary organ of government. So Congress is given the lion's share of our governing powers. You wouldn't necessarily think so today, but believe me, it's there on paper. Congress is given the lion's share of our governmental power. Why? Because it's the branch closest to the people. And the American people wanted to be able to have direct contact with those people exercising most of the governmental power, and that would be through the House of Representatives and, of course, the U.S. Senate. The various powers granted to the judiciary and the executive then would be a statement by the American people, to recur to James Iredale one more time, we've approved this particular allocation of power and this particular allocation of responsibilities and duties and none other. We've not approved anything else. So the maintenance of the powers granted to the three branches of government is an absolute requirement. Otherwise, we would be witnessing the diminution of our constitutional democracy. To put it in other words, if the president began to exercise legislative powers through the act of theft or usurpation, then that would mock the intentions of the people, exercise through ratification to say, we want these powers to go to Congress, not to the president. Thus, usurpation by the president, the assumption by the president of congressional powers would represent a statement of contempt for the right of the American people to choose which branch of government exercises which powers. And thus, as we would proceed, we would see that one of the perennial threats to American democracy would be presidential usurpation of congressional power by presidents of both parties, Republicans and Democrats, conservatives and liberals alike. This is not a partisan issue. It's a very difficult historical problem. The aggrandizement by Congress, by the president of congressional powers then would represent this contempt for the American people, as I've said, and it would also change the Constitution that we approved. So it's very important then for us to maintain that structural allocation of power. But over the course of American history, one of the perennial threats to our constitutional democracy has either been executive aggrandizement of power or congressional abdication of its powers. And this point, the fact that Congress would surrender many of its powers to the president, freely abdicate, is very interestingly a theme of both conservatives and liberals at different times. So just the other day, for example, I was reading an article in National Review. I try to read magazines with different political views just to show my objectivities. So you'll know I'm telling the truth when I'm here. An article in National Review, which leans right, it's a historic magazine that reflects conservative thought. At any rate, the author here is bemoaning the fact that Congress has abdicated its powers to the president for going all the way back decades into the 1950s. And what's interesting about that is that for many years, that had always been a liberal line, one that would fill the pages of magazines in the old New Republic, which at one point was a left-leaning magazine, or certainly in the Nation magazine, which is a liberal publication. So both parties or both ideological frames have at different times complained about congressional abdication of its responsibilities and powers. And down deep at the most basic level, what that represents, as I say, is a contempt for the American people and our right to choose how to allocate powers to the particular branches when we ratify the Constitution. So you see, this is not a partisan issue, is it? But the viewpoint staked out by each party may rise and fall depending on which party is in power, which party is in the White House. We accept that. Nevertheless, when we see those complaints rise to the level of bipartisanship, we know then that we have a major problem. If Congress abdicates its responsibility and allows the president, one person, to make more and more of the critical decisions, whether it's in unilateral war making, assumption of control over all trade agreements, the formulation and the operation of American foreign policy, then we move from the institutionalization of our governmental power back to the time of the personalization. We tend to drift backward toward the monarchical model, where more and more power is granted to the president. And what have we just seen in the last couple of days? We've heard that President Trump has talked to aides about withdrawing the United States from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which has been the backbone of our foreign policy alliance since World War II. If he were to do that, he would be claiming the unilateral authority to terminate a treaty, in the same way that presidents of both parties have asserted the unilateral authority to take the nation to war, despite the fact that that war power is granted to Congress. So you see the dangerous drift away from the institutionalization of power to the personalization. Now you might wonder, well, is that really so bad? What if we have a really smart visionary in the White House whose judgment and character are maybe superior to that of all the members of Congress combined? Thus, we would have a platonic guardian in the White House. Would that it were. But if we don't have that, then what we see is the danger of unilateralism, that decisions are being made in an arbitrary way based on the whims and the desires, maybe the character, the skewed judgment, the impulsiveness of a single individual. That's what the framers sought to avoid by institutionalizing power. So that's one area of concern when we talk about perennial threats to the American democracy, our failure at crucial moments to maintain the institutions established by the Constitution. And the blame for that, ladies and gentlemen, falls on the shoulders of both Republicans and Democrats, both liberals and conservatives. There's plenty of blame to go around. What we have witnessed is an unwillingness for people to shoulder the responsibility to maintain the institutions. If those institutions are diminished, then it's hard to provide corrective remedies to the arbitrariness of the people making decisions, whether it's decisions by the president or Congress or the courts. Because the key to maintaining governmental institutions is to be found in holding government accountable. We talk about that all the time in a democracy. In order to maintain our constitutional democracy, we have to hold government accountable. That's the responsibility of people in all three branches of government. It's the responsibility of the American citizenry, as James Madison explained in Federalist 51. It's certainly the responsibility of the free press. If we don't hold government accountable, then, in effect, we see the personalization of power. And that personalization of power can be made to move to the extreme right or the extreme left. We could see a radical form of government on the left. We could see a radical form on the right moving toward a fascist system. So you get an idea of the potential pitfalls here. Moreover, another perennial threat to constitutional democracy is to be found in the attack on the Bill of Rights, either an assault on the Bill of Rights, denying Americans their constitutionally guaranteed freedoms in the first 10 amendments, such as freedom of speech, freedom of religion, going on through due process of law and the right to a trial, and so on and so forth. If, in fact, the Bill of Rights is attacked by government itself through arbitrary presidential actions, congressional actions, or the failure of the courts to enforce the Bill of Rights, then that clearly represents a grave threat to our constitutional democracy. If we were to talk about this for 15 or 20 hours, I could offer you dozens and dozens of occasions in our history when the Bill of Rights has been under assault. Consider, for example, in 1798, the passage by Congress of the Alien and Sedition Act. The Sedition Act was particularly heinous. Passed by Congress just 7 years after the Bill of Rights went into effect, it essentially made it illegal to criticize American governmental officials in a way that would cause their reputation to plummet. Even though in the First Amendment, the language reads, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. What is criticism of governmental officials other than freedom of speech? When Congress then, in the context of this evolving war with France, passed the Sedition Act, making it illegal to criticize particular governmental officials, the assault on freedom of speech was on. Why would the Congress pass such a law? Because in times of crises, real or imagined, governmental leaders lose their minds. This was about the first time that happened, not the last. But more importantly, to focus this, our congressional leaders had begun to confuse dissent with disloyalty. To confuse dissent with disloyalty. We all recognize that the founding generation, which was committed to freedom of speech, represented the greatest dissenting generation in the history of America, and maybe the greatest dissenting generation in the history of the world. After all, they took on the English Empire. They criticized the government. They did not think that their critical speech, their dissents from English thoughts and practices represented disloyalty. They were trying to improve the English government, at least in the beginning. So committed were they to the idea that through freedom of speech, we could identify better policies and programs by focusing on the weaknesses in any particular program or policy, that they enshrined it in the First Amendment and provided in the most emphatic language possible, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. So the great dissenters were committed to the idea of providing constitutional protection to subsequent generations of dissenters so that they too could improve governmental practices. But if freedom of speech is assaulted by the government, then of course the very idea that free speech can provide a corrective remedy for governmental failures goes out the window. And even if it's not a direct attack on freedom of speech, if it's just governmental indifference to the occasional infringement on freedom of speech or any other liberty for that matter, the effect is the same. This is what we see sometimes when Congress passes laws that represent the most flagrant violations of our constitutional system, or the government as a whole erects policies and programs that represent flagrant violations of our rights and principles and our great traditions. Think, for example, of an executive order on February 19, 1942, when President Franklin D. Roosevelt announced the program to establish internment camps for Japanese Americans. The most flagrant abuse of civil rights for an entire group at one point in time. That was the action of the president. It was fortified by a statute enacted by Congress. And when the challenges came before the courts, including the Supreme Court upheld it. In that very, very dark day in the early 1940s then, we saw our entire government caved in to a fear from a foreign power, the fear that American citizens would fight for a foreign power rather than with our own government, despite the fact there was no evidence ever produced of any espionage activities or loyalty paid to the Japanese government. You see then that the framers' great fear about the three branches of government caving in, failing to do their responsibilities, indeed participating in a conspiracy against constitutional democracy, manifested moreover through the direct violation of the due process rights of Japanese American citizens, and you see what ugliness can be produced, either through a direct assault or indifference. No matter how you cut it, the result is the same. When we talk about the ugly history of racism in this country toward African Americans, you see a gross assault on the constitutional rights of black Americans. When we talk about the long indifference toward equal rights for women, now 250 years and counting, we see how the government has failed to defend that very, very important, indeed, the rock rib principle of the republic, which is equality for all. So we've seen enough history, and we could spend many, many hours talking about this. The question is, when we witness a direct assault by governmental branches, or we witness the assault through governmental indifference, the question arises, who's going to stand up and be counted? Who's going to protect our constitutional democracy when those dark days shadow America? One prime example, aside from these, that represented a direct assault on the Bill of Rights occurred during that period known as McCarthyism, characterized by the activities of Senator Joseph McCarthy of Wisconsin, whose activities, threats, and actions represented the deepest kind of oppression against American liberty. If you're not familiar with all that Joseph McCarthy and his ilk did to assault democracy, let me recommend a couple of good things to read. You could read, for example, a chapter in the best-selling book by a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, John Meacham, The Battle for the Soul of America, a terrific book. I know some of you have read it or are reading. I highly recommend that. If you want real detail, then let me recommend a wonderful book by David Kaut, C-A-U-T-E. It's called The Great Fear, which tracks McCarthyism in all of its manifestations in the 1950s in exacting detail. Beautifully written. It's about 700 pages, so it'll take you a weekend or so to get through that. But that is a comprehensive look at the reign of terror inflicted by Joseph McCarthy. So what did he do that raised the real concerns harbored by the framers of our Constitution? Here was a very powerful U.S. senator that attacked American institutions. By attacking American institutions, he would bring American democracy low and give flight to the fears of the framers of the Constitution. How did he attack American institutions? He began, number one, and this is in no particular sequence, he began to blame the State Department for the loss of China during the Civil War in China in 1949. He made the bizarre accusation, and as did others, that America had lost China to the communists in the Chinese Revolution led by Mao Zedong and had failed to back our longtime allies who were forced to flee to Formosa or Taiwan. That reflected, he said, the intervention of communists in the American government. At that same point in time, he began to argue in a series of speeches, beginning most famously in June of 1950 in Wheeling, West Virginia. He would complain about the number of communists who had infiltrated the American government, different bureaucracies, different offices and agencies, and he announced at this stop, "I have here in my hand a list of 205 known communists in this department." And then he would go down the road a bit, make another speech. "I have here in my hand a list of 200 known communists in this department." And he'd get back on the train, another stop, another list, another number, all made up. What he recognized, this incredibly ambitious politician with an understanding of how to exploit fear to his own advantage, what he recognized was that there was a growing fear of communism in America and around the world, and certain events had provided the backdrop for that fear, which could be easily exploited by an American politician searching for more and more power. And McCarthy was the pro at doing that. So much so that when he succeeded in persuading the press that it needed to follow him and write stories, page one stories about his speeches, the press became addicted to Joseph McCarthy. It could not avoid reporting what he was saying, what he was doing. He was a genius at manipulating the press. As one leading journalist at that time would say, McCarthy invented the idea of a morning press conference at which he would announce he was going to hold an afternoon press conference to make some bold statement. Thus, he was guaranteed headlines in the national newspapers and on the radios across the country because he said, at a morning press conference, I'm going to announce something really important this afternoon. And even if he didn't, look how he had succeeded in manipulating the media. Americans became addicted to Joe McCarthy as they followed the media reports about his comings and goings. The rising fear of communism, then stoked by politicians. McCarthy wasn't alone, and by the way, this was not entirely a partisan matter because there were Democrats who sought to exploit the fear of communism because many politicians were interested in acquiring more and more power. Just to give you one example, because we provide fair and balanced news here, Hubert Humphrey, the great civil rights champion, a senator from Minnesota, had introduced the idea in the early 1950s of building camps into which known communists or those suspected of being communists should be placed. Nothing could be more heinous from a civil libertarian perspective. He grew beyond that, fortunately, and became a great champion of civil rights. But the point is that you had both Republicans and Democrats trying to exploit the fears of Americans for their own political gains. McCarthy then not only attacked American institutions, their very independence, their competence, he attacked the courts for their rulings. He attacked the State Department. He attacked other agencies. He attacked Eisenhower for harboring communists in the Pentagon. He attacked the press if it wasn't doing what he expected the press to do. He was thus trying to bring an assault on the independent institutions of America. He had few opponents, very few courageous opponents, very few people who could exhibit what we would call civic courage. And interestingly, one of the first and foremost opponents was a woman, a U.S. senator from Maine, Margaret Chase Smith, who in June of 1950 had had enough of McCarthy and made a speech from the Senate floor without naming him, but denouncing the kinds of senators who were fanning the fears about communism to the point of irrationality that would lead Americans to desert our institutions. McCarthy, to put it simply, was a demagogue who had succeeded in acquiring great power. He bullied other senators. People in Washington, let me say this carefully, people in Washington were afraid to challenge him because he would come after them, and they did not want to have to bear the brunt of Joseph McCarthy's attacks. He was able to bully other institutions that, by virtue of their origin and their charters, were supposed to protect the American Constitution and the Bill of Rights, not a Freudian slip. The Bill of Rights. And so it took a few individuals to begin to challenge him. Edwin R. Murrow, the famous CBS newsman, did that in his nationally televised show, See It Now. When he attacked McCarthy, it helped to diminish McCarthy's status. And then in the Army-McCarthy hearings in 1954, brought about because McCarthy had made the grave error of accusing President Eisenhower, the hero of World War II, who had stopped Hitler, who had saved the world for democracy, of harboring communists in the Pentagon, that finally ignited a fire under Eisenhower. Eisenhower had been slow to come to the fight, whereas Harry Truman had fought McCarthy from day one. Eisenhower wasn't sure. His advisors had counseled that it would be better for him not to engage in a direct confrontation with McCarthy. Why? Because McCarthy was popular. He had 35% to 40% of the people who were not going to desert him no matter what he said or what he did, 35% to 40%. Something about that percentage rings some memory. I'm searching for that. And so Eisenhower was slow to come to the fight. He finally did it. And so with a few brave souls taking McCarthy on, we were led to the ultimate conclusion so familiar to us on the schoolyard where all you have to do is to stand up to a bully and you finally bring him down. A lesson for history. We don't acquiesce to bullies. We take them on, and that's how you ultimately stop them. But for that period of time, and we could spend many, many hours talking about this. I once taught a class for 15 weeks on Joseph McCarthy and the Constitution. It was a lot of fun, at least for me. I don't know how my students felt. But at any rate, much to talk about. But for that period, this very dark period in American history, the lights went out on the Bill of Rights. Separation of powers had been brought low because Congress was acquiescing to Joseph McCarthy. The courts had stopped defending the Constitution, had stopped defending free speech. Other organizations outside Washington were kowtowing to McCarthy and others like him. And so what that told us was, no matter how great the institutions were that were created by the framers, there was always this reminder that in order to maintain our constitutional democracy, we need men and women of integrity and courage at the helm of governmental offices and agencies, because the Constitution is not a thing that would go of itself. So as we move forward from McCarthyism and other kinds of challenges to our American democracy, not merely in the form of attacks on separation of powers, not merely in the form of attacks on American institutions, not merely in the attack on the Bill of Rights, we see the scourge of racism rising again. The challenge posed by racism in this country, whether we're talking about Charlottesville, Virginia, or any other place, reminds us then that when we talk about the core conditions of democracy, that they require vigilance. Our system is one that's built on the very premise that human dignity matters, that all people are deserving of protection for their dignity, manifested in the doctrine of natural rights and the Bill of Rights. When we practice racism, we are attacking the very fundamental feature of our American Republic, that all people are created equal. When we engage in racism, we're denying that premise. We're denying that all people are created equal. When we see racism, we are treating some as more equal than others. We are segregating America between the superior folks and the inferior folks, those who are first-class citizens and those who are third-class citizens. So, to the extent that racism is again on the rise in America, we see that as representing a grave threat to American democracy. When we see the ongoing battle involving sexism, we see a threat to American democracy. to recur to a point that I introduced briefly last week, saving for more discussion this week, when we look at three fundamental conditions in America that have to be satisfied if we dare to call ourselves a democracy, we look at certain economic conditions and social conditions and political conditions. Fundamentally, we maintain in our country that we, from a social standpoint, we do, as I say, need to treat people as equals, and that means we cannot tolerate any kind of discrimination based on race or gender or otherwise. And how are we doing here in America when it comes to discrimination against people of color? How are we doing here in America when we find that women still do not enjoy equal rights in the country? How are we doing on the social front when we see violence? How are we doing when we see organized violence or a high level of violent attacks to the use of firearms? How are we doing there? And how are we doing on the economic front? Here in Idaho, just consider here in Idaho, where 20% of Idahoans work one or two jobs and are still receiving some state assistance. The problem is if people are working most of the day to make ends meet, to find dinner, to put a roof over their heads, to scratch up the money to go see a doctor, they don't have time to think deeply or to think at all about American policies, laws, programs, policies. The very kind of intense engagement in American politics that the framers hoped our system would produce. If you're hungry and you're looking for your next meal, or you're without shelter, you're not going to give much thought to what Congress is doing or the president is doing. You don't have the leisure time necessary to participate. So any country that wants to characterize itself as a democracy has to reach that point where we don't have the problem of poverty, where people are looking for their next meal. That's a major problem. When we talk about campaign contributions from the great class of wealthy in America, somebody wondered last week, what about that? Is that a particular problem? And I indicated the Supreme Court's decision in Citizens United represents a grave threat to American democracy. Here's why. If we turn the clock back to the framers' generation, they had taken as a fundamental lesson what the English had taught, and that is that power follows property. Power follows property. If you are wealthy, you're going to have influence in politics. Everybody aspires to wealth. We get that. But what the framers hoped was that through regulations, legislation, opportunities, that we would not have a great split between the haves and the have-nots. Because if that occurs, then we see that the great hope of a democracy, of spreading political power widely, of bringing as many people as possible into the participatory net, becomes just a dream. It becomes an imaginary goal. So if, in fact, we have a great divide between the haves and the have-nots, it means those with tremendous wealth are going to control politics, and they will make decisions that reflect their interests and their values, not necessarily decisions that will help those who are among the have-nots. And I told you last week, that's why the ancient Greeks, the ancient Athenians, did not vote, but resorted to the device of the lot so that all people would be required to serve in a governmental capacity, at least for a short time, guaranteeing that we would have many, many different viewpoints heard in the process of governance. Here we have a problem in America where 1% of the people own roughly 85 to 90% of all the wealth, depending on the studies. The number will vary, But as far back into the 1960s, when scholars began to examine this phenomenon, it was determined that the 1% would own at least 80% of the wealth, or 90. That doesn't leave a lot of opportunity for those who are not in the top 1%. That represents a threat to democracy because it's going to diminish the many different views that might otherwise be represented in our governing circles. We're running out of time here, so let me wrap up this portion of the program with a few final thoughts. In the Federalist Papers, particularly in Federalist 51, James Madison said the maintenance of our constitutional system does hinge upon the preservation of separation of powers and checks and balances, but it also hinges on the availability and willingness of a vigilant citizenry. We, the people, then, would have a great interest in preserving the system that we built, that we ratified, that is established to serve our interests so that the system truly reflects that great encomium, government of, by, and for the people. For Madison and the founders, there was a rhetorical question. Who more than we, the people, have a greater interest in the preservation of our democratic republic? Thank you. I'll stop here. So let's go back to the Q&A now, and we'll have a perfect closure. Kelly, does that microphone work?
I think so.
We hope so. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Could you address briefly the legal thread from McCarthy to the Trump's father and son with Roy Cohn and his vision of what was legal and what wasn't?
That's a great question. Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that opportunity. So let me take the first 20 hours to answer that. So as you point out, that connection between Joseph McCarthy and Roy Cohn in the 1950s. Roy Cohn advised Joseph McCarthy. Cohn was a scurrilous lawyer for whom the ends justified the means. And when you raise the question of how he perceived the law, that seems like an oxymoron, because Roy Cohn was dedicated to winning in any way by any measure necessary. Cohn advised McCarthy and thus helped him to acquire great power, learning how to manipulate the press, how to handle accusations. His assertion was simply, or his advice was, deny. Deny, deny, deny. Never admit that you made a mistake. Never accept fault. And attack your accusers. No matter what anybody is saying in the form of criticism, attack your accusers. That was Roy Cohn's Bible for McCarthy. When Roy Cohn also then advised a younger Donald Trump back in the 70s and the 80s, he provided the same kind of advice to Donald Trump. And that's why we see an imitation of McCarthy's behavior in Donald Trump. In the same way we said that Joseph McCarthy was a master in learning how to handle the press, calling a meeting to say, you should be at my press conference because I'm going to have a very important announcement, to distract the public, McCarthy was good at that, to move the narrative, we see those same, dare I say, gifts and skills in Donald Trump. His opponents and admirers would see that same thread that you describe. So in the same way that McCarthy learned well under the tutelage of Roy Cohn, I think that a younger Donald Trump learned his lessons very well. And so like his predecessor, he is able to manipulate the press. Americans have become addicted to President Trump. The certain news channels certainly report everything he does, and it raises a fundamental question that journalists now are discussing and debating. Is it the case that the press should report on everything that the American president does. What an interesting question. Should the press report what the president does? At first blush, we would say, of course, because he's the president. Everything he says and does is newsworthy. But that same question was raised during the McCarthy period, when some pretty progressive visionary editors around the paper, around the news, around the country said, we need a new form of newspaper coverage. We need to ask ourselves, is it the job of journalism to simply report what McCarthy says, or indeed, should the press also be willing to say in a story, this is a lie? Now, that was a radical concept at that point in time, because people had assumed the press had a role in simply reporting what was said, what was done. But when the members of the press realized they had a new kind of politician in Joseph McCarthy, a demagogue who was very skillful at manipulating the press, told lies in city after city, state after city after state, and these lies were being reported for the Americans to consume, the press began to view itself as an arm of McCarthy. Rather than as a neutral, they were helping McCarthy promote his lies. Is that the role of the press? So the debate ensued. Reporting, yes, but also when there is a very, very clear, patently clear, pellucidly clear lie told by McCarthy, it's okay to say in the story, this is not true. Because otherwise the press simply becomes an arm, an aid for that politician. You all know it's the same kind of deep debate that journalists around the country are having today, because as we've observed, a number of fact checkers around the country have been able to identify quite a few fibs or lies by President Trump. Not simply statements that are in the gray area, but demonstrably untrue, and so the reporters face the same challenge today as they faced in the 50s. How will the public respond? Indeed, you could ask yourselves this question, how would the public respond if we see a news story about something Donald Trump says, and then there is the insertion, this is not true, demonstrably untrue. Do we, the reading public, feel served, well served by the press? Or do we feel that the press is going beyond acceptable lines? If we feel we're well served because we think that the role of the press is to report the facts and the truth, then sometimes reporting the facts and the truth requires a sentence, this is demonstrably untrue. If we don't think that's the role of the press, if all we think the press should do is report what the president says, not to correct, not to provide the facts, not to say this is demonstrably untrue, then the media becomes an organ for the president, and it's a way of converting American newspapers into state-run media. And that cannot be healthy for a democracy that the framers of the Constitution said depends upon facts and evidence in our discussion and debates. But you recognize the conundrum. And this would not be a partisan issue. This would be a matter of concern no matter who's in office if that person is in fact spooling out some demonstrably untrue statements. Quite an issue. Thank you. That was a great question. Where are we? Right there. Same neighborhood.
All right. This goes back to the abrogation of power from the legislature over to the presidency or something. Two or three days ago, I heard one news release that said that the Senate had overrode the Senate Majority Leader and had voted to prevent the Treasury Department from presenting monies to a foreign government. I didn't pay that much attention to it because I expected to hear that in the ensuing days if I've ever heard it again. That's the first thing. And the second thing is it possible for the Senate to do that?
Very good question. So on the general theme, yes, the majority of the Senate can override the Senate Majority Leader, but if that happens more than a couple times, that person will lose his role as Senate Majority Leader. And it also depends upon the Majority Leader being willing to bring a matter to the floor to which he's opposed. So it's very, very rare that that happens. So when you hear these occasional stories, you know that there's a rebellion within the ranks. And I suspect that members of the Republican Party in the Senate are not too far away from staging a rebellion if, in fact, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell will not allow the appropriations bill to go forward to fund the government to reopen. So I think we're going to see these conflicts. We recognize you can be sympathetic to Mitch McConnell here, if you will, for a moment. At least play the game. He does not want to see members of his party present a bill that the president will not sign, because then there's open rebellion. If there's open rebellion, it undermines the president's strength, it undermines the majority leader's strength, and then he won't be able to govern that chamber. Plus, he opens himself up for a challenge. And his greatest fear would be disarray among Republicans as the election for the presidency gets closer and closer. We're going to see this, and I think the kind of thing you're talking about, we're going to see when the issue comes to maintaining sanctions on particular Russian officials. Many in Congress, indeed many in the country, want to see the continuation of these harsh sanctions imposed upon the Russian oligarchs who were involved, our intelligence agencies tell us, and from what we already know from the Mueller indictments, who were involved in trying to manipulate the 2016 election to aid President Trump. That's what all 17 of our agencies have told us. We're going to see this is a problem, particularly because the president wants to see those sanctions relaxed. Well, this is an odd time for the president to want, and Steve Mnuchin, the treasurer, to want to relax those sanctions when, in fact, those people against whom the sanctions have been leveled are, in fact, key players in what is regarded as a conspiracy with respect to the 2016 election. So not good timing. So we'll see. Thank you. Where are we? Right here, please. Come forward a little bit. Thank you, Kelly.
That question about the Senate bringing that to the floor, it was a minority leader because of when they put this, when they put that sanctions on, there was a section of that restriction that said that the minority leader could bring it to a vote. And so he did. And first it was a procedural, and 11 Republican senators voted to bring it to the floor. Unfortunately, they needed a total of 60 to override it. So the sanctions are going to be lifted against Deripaska and all these other people. And it stems back to the Magnitsky Act, uh-huh, and why Obama put those sanctions on. So,
thank you very much. Thanks very much for keeping me honest. I'm sorry I failed to answer the first part of your question. I started on number two, so thank you. And that vote fell 3 votes short of reaching the 60-vote threshold. Thank you. Please.
Yeah, I have actually 2 questions, if I may. The first question is, when the Bill of Rights was written, was there a method or a conscious decision in the order with which that they were written down and assigned? The second question is a combination of some of what you've been talking about this evening and then last week as well. When you were talking about having the local officials being elected, believing that they would do right by the people that elected them when they were performing their duties for the federal government. What I've seen in the 30-odd years that I've been paying particular attention is I believe that the power of the parties has now disrupted that as well. And I'm interested in your thoughts on that. You know, when I was a kid, there were Democrats that sided with Reagan. There were Republicans that worked with Clinton. In the last 15, 20 years, it seems to be I will vote for no one other than my party. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on that.
Thank you. Two very good questions. So on the first question, did the founders in writing the Bill of Rights have particular preferences that influenced the order or the sequence of the appearance of rights and liberties? No, other than the First Amendment seemed to be critical. The First Amendment embodying free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, because the founders understood, as Madison said, that you could not have a republic without freedom of speech, and particularly, he said, without freedom of the press. It's interesting, we sometimes don't recognize that for the founders, freedom of the press was as important or more important for the preservation of the republic than freedom of speech. Why? Because it would be the only way, or the principal way at least, in which we would be informed about the activities of government. And if we were not informed, we would have no basis for examining governmental behavior and determining that it's strong or weak or needs to be tweaked somehow, and certainly would not be able to hold government accountable. So the First Amendment embodies those magisterial rights necessary to the maintenance of a democratic republic. Your second point, I think, is hugely important. What's become of political parties in this country? Americans have always had a love-hate affair with political parties, and scholars over the last century, writing about the role of political parties in political science journals, have gone back and forth as to the utility, the desirability, the nature, and form of political parties. So, allowing for only a few minutes to cover 100 years of discussion and debate, we would say that political parties are useful and indeed in many ways necessary to organize like-minded people to come together in an organization to advance their views, their values, and to advocate for their causes. So we recognize that organizational feature. But eventually, no matter how tightly knit a political party is or how tightly knit a particular organization is, they're bound to emerge certain fractures based on different political views on particular issues, particularly those that might divide states among states, regions against region, states against the national government. Those things happen. The question then turns to the issue of party leadership. How effective are party leaders in trying to hold the members together? And is it possible to do that? So sometimes parties can do great things to move the country forward. Think about some of the great social legislation in this country, Social Security, Medicare, the most popular governmental program we have, and a good many others, all were a function of strong party leadership. But eventually, as parties become, let us say, too centralized, party leadership becomes too centralized in the hands of a few, those people who are not able to function very effectively or independently begin to chafe under the strong party leadership model, and they want to exercise independence. Imagine all of us go to Congress and somebody's been Senate Majority Leader for a long time or Speaker of the House, and you don't have the freedom you hope to have to bring measures or to even participate in the debate. You're going to chafe under that kind of centralized leadership. That's when we see rebellions within the party, and then power is decentralized. We saw this in the Republicans in the Republican Party after Watergate. Many believed that the party had become too centralized. Same thing has happened to the Democratic Party at different times. So it's always a tough matter to balance the aim of having the party leaders enjoy enough authority to govern, and yet allowing independence to other members of the party so they can make their voices heard. So it's a tough matter, and we see an ebb and flow across the decades involving the utility of parties, the assessed effectiveness of parties, and the disappointment in parties. Thank you. A couple more questions. Yes, please.
Hi. I had a question. When you were suggesting that we, like, review how well we have done in, like, ensuring the equality of, you mentioned, like, race and gender, you said, how are we doing when it comes to, like, ensuring women's equality? Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it felt like you were implying that we aren't doing well, like that we still have places we need to be better in. And I'm wondering if you could share where you think we need to be improving there.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. That's a very important question to ask. So when we talk about gender equality in the country, we recognize, A, how women still lag behind men in the political arena. We have yet to have a female president. Women are underrepresented in the U.S. Senate, U.S. House of Representatives. It's always been so. Even if it's improved in this last election, it's been relatively marginal. Same thing in the state legislatures across the country. So in the political arena, just in general terms, women lag behind. Women also lag behind, as you may know, when it comes to equal pay. So white women earn about 79 cents on the dollar earned by men. That's a significant gap. It's worse for women of color, for Asians, for Hispanics, for African-American women. So the wage gap is huge. And we also see, for example, that women are underrepresented in the corporate boardrooms. They do not have the same number of seats, so to speak, so they're not exercising the same power. Those are just a few areas illustrating the gap. Now, you want to respond. Here, let me give you the mic. There we go.
Okay. This is my... I anticipated you might bring up the wage gap. That's usually the main thing people go to, for good reason, obviously. My view on it is that clearly, yeah, women do lag behind in like the overall spectrum of the workforce, where they do, like, taking a broad, complete, like, every dollar that a woman makes to every dollar that a man makes. But I believe that that is not institutionalized, but rather, like, women are given the same opportunity. And So I'm curious. Does anybody, can anybody offer an example of how institutionally women don't have the same opportunities as men?
Thank you for your persistence. I admire that. That's great. We find that gender discrimination is institutionalized in America. Not only from the fact that women have to overcome high hurdles not faced by men in local, but particularly state and national races. Think back to the whole focus on Hillary Clinton. Should she wear pants to look more like a man, right? That's institutionalized gender discrimination. We see it reflected in the corporate boardrooms, gender, the wage gap, as you indicated. But we also find it, and you'll appreciate this, in the Me Too movement, right? That laws have not adequately protected women from sexual harassment, from sexual violence. The statute passed in the early 90s, the Violence Against Women Act, you may recall, was all about trying to protect women from violence, often sexual violence, but particularly in the Broadway violence, because without that protection, they couldn't leave the home to get a job or go to school. So that kind of institutionalized gender discrimination is a huge problem in America as well. So we could go on and on about that. But let me suggest, if because you're interested in that, I'm glad you are, go online and read some of the writings by leaders, including Dr. Caroline Heldman, who's spoken here and spoken elsewhere. And she's a leader, for example, in organizing a national effort against campus rape and also in defending women, accessing equal rights for women. Anyway, thanks for raising those questions. You can see that you've raised a controversy. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Where are Kelly? Where are you? Over here, and then we'll wrap up. Thanks. Please.
Yeah, I was wondering if you had any examples from elsewhere in the world of a healthy democracy that could serve as a model for us. What are they doing right that we're not?
Wow, great question. So here we enter the realm of comparative democracy. So there would be other countries where we could admire some of their practices and activities. I think there are reasons to admire some of the practices, laws, programs in the Scandinavian countries, for example, so as to, when we look at those fundamental conditions that we call social and economic and political. In the economic realm, for example, in a couple of Scandinavian countries, we find that people have national health care, which is true for many countries, most countries in the Western world. So that means that people don't have to worry about that problem. And again, if you don't have access to affordable health care, then you're not going to have time to theorize about principles and policies and programs. And also combating poverty is another success. We could take a look at the great progress made in Germany, particularly, I would say, in the last 20 years. Switzerland, I see my Swiss friend here. We have a number of countries who have social programs that eliminate some of the hurdles to the achievement and the maintenance of democracy, just as a brief answer to what you raised. Thank you. Where are we, Kelly? Okay. Please. Yes, please.
This is just a comment, not a question. We just saw the movie On the Basis of Sex about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Yes. And I'm a young bride of the 60s. And I think even back then, I was in ignorant bliss, didn't even know how I was put upon, because I was in the home and I didn't even attempt to get out of the home into the working field till later. And then things became apparent. But we've come a long ways, but we've got a long ways to go.
I think that's well said. We've made a lot of significant progress, but still not enough. And so Justice Ginsburg, in the movies about RBG, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and it's well done, but she is still a proponent of the Equal Rights Amendment because she wants to see in the Constitution a guarantee of equal rights for women. There's great power in stating it in the law of the land. I saw that movie this weekend, really enjoyed it, as did you, and I think as some of you know, I'm writing a book about Reed versus Reed, which is the landmark case that came out of Idaho, first time that the United States Supreme Court ever struck down a statute on grounds of gender discrimination. Justice Ginsburg was kind enough to grant me an interview. She's been very helpful. She's writing a foreword to the book. So I'm sprinting to finish. And I was just so happy when I saw the film that they didn't spend a lot of time about Reed versus Reed. I've never been so nervous watching a movie thinking, oh, they're going to steal my thunder. But anyway, it was a nice touch. It was a nice touch. Let's see, Kelly, let's have one more question and then we'll wrap it up. Kelly, right over here are two more questions and then right over here. Here, let's go here. Let's go there, let's go here. Whatever you prefer.
if we, going back to the wage gap in particular, that seems to be a hot button issue. The earlier comment was mentioned that, you know, if you average it out, sure, you can see that, but there are specific examples. And I think what's important to look at is we do have that average, 79 cents on the dollar. And maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong, and you can add to this thought that comes down to a few different statements. Women are choosing to make less money. Women are not able, because there are some, you know, second class humans, they're, you know, physically, mentally not capable, or there is a glass ceiling. There is discrimination. The powers that be are preventing. And it seems like those three pretty much encompass it. Do you think there would be more to it than that?
No, I think you've provided a really nice review. All three are at play. The reality is that there's still discrimination against women based on factors that shouldn't be considered. A young woman, well, you're going to become pregnant, you'll leave. Why should we, in fact, spend time training you when you're going to leave? Or when you come back to take the job, you have to take your return to your job, if you get it at all, at a lower level. So all kinds of discriminatory forces are in effect here. But there remains a high level of discrimination against women. Even Justice Ginsburg acknowledged that at the Supreme Court level, there's no good way to explain why the Supreme Court has yet to apply the strict scrutiny doctrine to discrimination against women in the way the court applied it to African Americans way back in 1954 in Brown versus the Board of Education. Too many people in power still think that for various reasons men deserve a higher wage. That's the institutionalization of gender discrimination when it comes to the gender pay gap, and that's what leads to equal pay for equal work. Yeah, thank you. We're going to come back to that in week four when we talk about remedies to make American democracy perfect. No pressure there. Okay, one more, and then I better let you go, please.
Okay. I think I'm understanding where you may be coming from, because you make a really good point, and that is when you talk about institutionalization, are we talking about law or are we talking about culture? Because when you look at the Constitution, you think of law, you're thinking of where are the laws that protect us? And I think currently we're finding that we need a whole lot of new laws because things are so vague, you know. But if you could just comment on that, the difference between, as you're referring to institutionalization, law and culture, and how do those two come together?
Yeah, thank you for putting a fine point on it. We find institutionalized gender discrimination both in American law and in culture. And historically, we say law follows cultural practices until the law is able to reform the culture. There's always a lag. So that's useful for me to say, isn't it? So when we talk about the cultural forces at work, then we see a view still widely held that women simply aren't the equals of men. They're inferior. Whether it's in the performance of some physical jobs, some brain work, to put it gently, or in other areas as well. There are simply those who, for cultural, sometimes religious reasons, who see women as second-class citizens. That's the cultural leg. Those cultural values, then, are embodied in laws because those lawmakers embody the values that, in fact, they put into the laws. Aristotle used to say the best way to create reform is to get the right values packed into the law, and that's what we're talking about here. So, to your point, we still have a good many laws that permit gender discrimination, and those are rampant across the nation. On that doctrine of strict scrutiny, I would take some time to explain. When the court reviews governmental policies or programs or laws, it has different levels of scrutiny that it will engage in reviewing the law in question to determine how much deference should be paid to the law. So the lowest level is what we call the rational basis doctrine. We say courts will review, a state law and say, if there is a rational basis for this distinction based on gender, then it's acceptable. With respect to race relations, the Supreme Court said in 1954 in Brown versus the Board of Education, there is no acceptable distinction in laws based on race. Can't ever do it. So we would hope in this country that the Supreme Court would embrace that same approach, that same level of scrutiny called strict scrutiny, and say there are no justifiable distinctions in American law based on sex or based on gender. That's where we want to get to. Now, in my book, in explaining what Justice Ginsburg says, she says, well, it's also important to look at what courts do, that we don't necessarily have to focus on the doctrine, which will be a surprise to a lot of professors of law who teach the doctrines, but it's important to note what the court does. And what she says about where we are on the matter of gender discrimination on the basis of sex now is that the only justification that would permit a distinction between men and women is if there is, quote, an exceedingly persuasive justification. I don't know what that is, but you can imagine it's a high bar, so it's becoming more difficult. But it would require the rewriting of many laws all across the country. That will take some time, but to your good point, it takes cultural reform. You have to elect people to office who believe in the passage of laws that would prohibit gender discrimination. And that would be the calling for American citizens, unless you believe women are second-class citizens. And nobody here wants to maintain that. Not safely so. So, thanks very much. This has been a lot of fun for me tonight. I hope you come back. We'll talk about leadership in democracy next week. Thanks for your good questions. Good night. Thank you. Oh, yes. Thank you. Yes, we like this. Yeah. Thank you. You're all too good. You're too good to me. Thank you.